I think you have to work as a European. Your national identity, you have to leave it at the doors. Otherwise, you will never be a real European lawyer. You will be doing something else, but not European law.
You're listening to Europa Felix. I'm Felix Ronkes-Agerbeek, and my guest for this episode is Julio Baquero Cruz, novelist, translator, professor of EU law, and member of the legal service of the Commission. In 2018, he published a book called What's Left of the Law of Integration, in which he observes that the European Union is going through a difficult period, a traversée du désert. He describes the waning of the initial impetus behind European integration and a resurgence of the idea that the nation state is the ultimate political unit. He notices signs of decline in European law, even signs of disintegration. But the book is not defeatist, and he also describes acts of resistance, especially in the case law of the Court of Justice. And more importantly, he encourages us to look again at the beginnings of the law of integration to find new meaning for European law today. Julio's book combines philosophical contemplation with legal technical detail, and so does my conversation with him. We talk about one of the founding fathers of the law of integration, Pierre Pescatore. We discuss political speeches from Thatcher to Merkel to Scholz. We take a deep dive into the Weiss judgment of the German Constitutional Court. We talk about the theory that European integration was mainly a means of rescuing the nation state. And finally, I ask him how we can reclaim the law of integration. I should mention that Julio and I both work for the European Commission, but that, of course, on this show, we speak in a personal capacity. Here is Julio Baquero Cruz. Julio, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to start from the beginning with a very basic question, namely, what is the law of integration and where does it come from?
The term the law of integration was coined by Pierre Pescatore in a book he published in 1972. And Pescatore was the first one who said that the phenomenon of integration, economic, political, was followed or matched by a phenomenon of legal integration. For Pescatore, and I think for many scholars of community law in the early period, all the way until the 80s or 90s, the law of integration was embodied or reflected in a series of legal structures. The preliminary rulings procedure, primacy, direct effect, state liability. There was a sort of building of legal principles that would keep the communities together as a legal reality, as an autonomous legal reality.
And what was the rationale for this? What does integration in this sense tried to do?
What integration wants to do, tries to do, is to of course limit the sovereignty of the member states, to frame their behavior, their very existence in a higher overarching legal and institutional framework, so that the horrors, the barbarism of the 20th century would not be seen again in the heart of, in brackets I say, civilization. Yeah. So I think that was the aim of the whole enterprise. I think it's important to realize that without the wars, this new configuration of relationships between states and this new conception of the state would have been totally impossible. The state, by being part of the Union, changes its nature. This is what integration is about. And the Union frames and tames the state, which is no longer a sovereign unit because its sovereignty is limited, pooled, and to that extent exercised together in common institutions and with the own procedures of the Union.
Of course, there's almost nobody left who has first-hand experience of the horrors, the barbarism that acted as the catalyst for integration. And in your book, you point out that, and I quote, "We increasingly detach European integration and its law from the extreme conditions that made them possible." You write, "We do remember, but at the same time, we seem to have become insensitive to the lasting force of that historical experience and do not realize that the world we live in was built upon those ruins and mountains of corpses and because of them."
Yeah, this is the Benjaminian idea of history. Walter Benjamin, the philosopher, wrote that wonderful piece on the 10 theses, I think, on the philosophy of history. And his idea, which is sounds a bit gloomy, but I think it's quite realistic, is that history is made of a succession of ruins, and that every document of civilization is actually also a document of barbarism. And I make the point that the treaties should also be seen not only as documents of not civilization, but the struggle for civilization, for having civilized relations between nations. Also, they have to be seen as documents of the barbarism that made them possible. And if we don't see that, we miss that connection, we miss that point. We start to see the treaties as something, you know, purely technical, cold, about representing just the interests of the member states, the sort of view that some member states sometimes are tempted to have about the European Union. So yes, we remember, we know about the history, we know about the Shoah, we know about the war, and the casualties. What we don't have is the feelings that the generation that lived through that, the kind of education, sentimental education, let's say, what they learned about the state, about the destructive power of the state. We don't have those feelings. And that means that we may lack the ability to understand the meaning, I mean the deep meaning of the structures that we have inherited. And when I talk about those structures, I think about the community method, what it means by allowing to adopt decisions by majority and not through unanimity. Or I think about direct effect or primacy, something that allows for the creation of a supranational legal order that frames in a binding way the way states and peoples organize their relationships in a common legal area. I think that's quite revolutionary. And without the wars, the two of them, all of that would have been impossible. I think the wars were an eye-opener about the increasingly destructive nature of insulated states in the age of ideologies, yeah, which was the 20th century, and our century still remains an age of ideologies, different ideologies, but still with the same destructive potential.
You mentioned the late Pierre Pescator. He belonged to a generation that had the sentimental education you talked about. He belonged also to the circle of lawyers that built and consolidated the law of integration, part of the group of legal experts that drafted the Rome Treaty, judged at the Court of Justice for almost 20 years, and you knew him personally. How did you two meet?
That's a curious story. When I was studying EU law first in Bruges and then in Florence, I read his book, Le droit de l'intégration, the law of integration, which I found was fantastic. He was extremely clear and coherent and integral in his legal thinking. No concessions, no half measures. And I read a lot of his articles as well. Let's say I felt a strong affinity with him in my studies. When I read his things, I thought, I agree with that. I like that. This is the way I like to think about the law. And this made me want to meet him. And so when I started working at the court at the end of 2000, they gave me at the court, I don't know if this is done today, but they gave me a list with the addresses and names of all the former members of the court. Today, that maybe would be against the GDPR.
I think so.
Unless they had consented. Of course, maybe they would consent. But it was nice to have it. And I gathered some courage and I called the telephone of Mr. Pescator. It was his wife who answered. And immediately he took the phone and he invited me for lunch at his study. He was retired then, of course, and he had a place to work and study full of books not far away from his house. And for the 4 years I spent at the court, we used to meet every month So I met him many, many times, and we had very, very fruitful conversations. I learned a lot from him.
What was that like? What did you talk about?
Well, it was a two-way exchange all the time, because he was extremely down to earth, extremely modest, and he listened. He listened to me, and it was astonishing. I mean, I was in my 20s, and I was surprised that he would listen to me. He was telling me things about the court. And when we talked about law, our conversations were about what had happened in the 60s, in the 70s, so the creation and consolidation of the law of integration. Or he wanted to know what was going on at the court. Another topic that came later was the European Convention. I was following at the time the European Convention at the cabinet of the president. And so he was very interested in knowing what was going on with the European Convention. Those were our legal conversations. Yeah, and he told me a lot of secrets. He said to me once, he said, you are bound by the secrecy of deliberations, because all the referendaire at the court have this obligation not to reveal these secrets, so I can tell you this and I can tell you that. And I've never told anybody all these secrets.
Until today on this podcast.
No, I cannot tell the stories because they were given...
in confidence.
Yeah.
So Pescatore's book was called The Law of Integration. In your book, the title is What's Left of the Law of Integration.
The book has a question mark. It doesn't explain what's left of the Law of Integration. It asks the question, and it's a real question, because at some point in the 90s, I think, some of the elements of this law of integration started to be contested from various fronts, in legal terms and also in political terms. And so after that period, I think, the practice of the law of integration has been a practice of resistance, not so much building, but resisting and keeping what had been built in terms of main principles in the 60s, 70s, 80s. That's at least the approach I tried to explore in the book.
And you observe that in recent times, there has been a waning sense of what integration is about.
We are living in that moment. We've been living in that moment for maybe more than a decade, that the political classes, I think, especially, sometimes don't see what the union is about.
But hasn't this tension between supranationalism and intergovernmentalism, hasn't that been there from the outset?
It's always there, and it's inherent to the organization. It's a tension you find in every kind of multi-level system or federal system, and it will remain. Of course, not everything in the treaties follows the model of integration. Yeah, this is an ideal type. For example, in Article 114, the legal basis on the internal market, wherever you have the ordinary legislative procedure, that's the notion of integration in institutional terms. But the treaty also has several islands of intergovernmentalism. That's the opposite or the other end, the other ideal type of a conception of relationships between the states that is not reframed by this notion of integration. That is simply a matter of cooperation, agreement unanimously when they want to agree. But if you have unanimity, there is no transfer of sovereignty. This is clear in the case law from many constitutional courts, because you can always veto, block. So the power remains with the state. There is no recognition of a broader, wider instance of political power that can bind you against your will. The problem I see is that the element of integration, the element of the community method, if it's not valued, if we don't understand what it means and why it's there, the union could become something different, a mere organization of cooperation where states may decide things in common if they want, but only when their interests correspond or converge sufficiently.
But is that new? Is that something that has changed?
I think that has changed. The perception of what the European Union is about has changed, I think.
And why is that?
There are various reasons. One of them is this lack of historical memory. Another issue is the enlargement. The member states that came into the Union later, even much later, have a different view, a different story. They were disconnected from this long story of integration. If they thought about it, they would come to see it in the same way. even strongly. But there is a disconnection there. There is an interrupted discourse. Also because the element of the member state through the enlargement is bigger. So in relative terms, the member state is a massive presence. When you have 27 judges or 27 members of the commission, 27 members in the council, it becomes much more an organization of member states. I don't know if I express my idea.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. The relative weight of the member states vis-a-vis the common organization has become much bigger. It's actually quite easy to see when you're working in the European institutions. You mentioned earlier the political classes. And indeed, it seems that the term integration, European integration, has disappeared from political discourse.
There is a speech which I think marks the end of talk about integration, and that's the speech of Chancellor Merkel at the College of Europe in 2010. And it's all about cooperation. We do things together, and there is a union method, she says there, I think for the first time. It's on a par with the community method. So the community method doesn't have any advantage or any primacy. You can, if you like, you can apply the intergovernmental method as well. You go to the European Council and suddenly you are in a different world.
I reread this speech before our talk, and one of the things that actually struck me about it is that she speaks about this notion of coordination of a European Union method, maybe, if necessary, combined with the community method. And then, as an example, and I thought that was quite striking, she gives energy policy.
Yes.
And I thought, historically, that's interesting because, of course, the coal and steel community is where it all started. It was very much the birth of the community method. But also, fast forward to today, where, again, in the context of a war, we see that energy is one of these big common challenges and that we're so interdependent. I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is precisely one of those areas where it's vital to think in terms of the broader interest of the Union instead of some sort of common denominator of national interests.
Yes. She sees the Treaty of Lisbon as having changed the institutional framework, which is a rather daring proposition, I think, because the Treaty of Lisbon is just a codification of the institutional framework. And then she seems to give the impression that at any given point in time, you could shift a matter to the European Council and decide in a different mode, which is the mode of cooperation between reconstructed sovereign states. And that trumps completely the community method. The court is not mentioned at all in her speech. Integration is not mentioned even once. I mean, if you compare that speech with previous speeches of German chancellors and so on and so forth, it's night and day. It sounds very much like the speech that Margaret Thatcher gave at the College of Europe in the 80s. And that speech was hugely contested by the other member states at the time. They said, this is not our community. And so with the Merkel speech, we seem to come full circle to a prior state of affairs, of the understanding of the state in Europe.
Of course, that was more than 10 years ago.
But I don't think much has changed in the meantime, because the speech of Chancellor Scholz the other day in Prague, he doesn't mention integration at all. And his speech is also very much a speech of, it's the member states. The masters of the thing is the member states. So the states are the protagonists of this story. And the union is perceived as a vehicle. It doesn't have a substance of its own. And this is the whole fight of integration.
But wait, I want to push back a little bit on that. Because first of all, in the Prague speech, of course, and I'm not saying that we should attach too much value to these speeches in the end, but first of all, he starts with recalling the historical experience that underpins European integration. And he clearly does that to set the stage for what follows in his speech. And then, one of the key things that he says he wants is qualified majority voting, an extension of qualified majority voting, including in tax policy and in the common foreign and security policy.
It's true. No, don't get me wrong. The speech of Scholz is very different from the speech of Merkel of
Thatcher.
or Thatcher of 2010 or of the 80s. Yeah, it's progressive. It proposes some things. Nevertheless, in the rhetoric, he's very contained. And there are a variety of things. He proposes that the Commission should keep one commissioner per member state, for example, where I mean, in the treaties already, this is not the principle. The Commission should already have less commissioners. So it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that in the speech of Mr. Scholz.
I want to stick with Germany for a moment, but change the focus to the German Constitutional Court. In your book, you dedicate a lot of attention to the relationship between national courts and the Court of Justice. And you also discussed the Gauweiler case, which was the first case in which the German Constitutional Court made a reference for a preliminary ruling. The second case in which that happened, the Weiss case, occurred after the publication of your book. But you recently wrote an essay called Karlsruhe and its Discontents that analyzes the Weiss judgment in great detail. And to me, reading that essay felt like reading an addendum to your book. Now, I'm sure every EU lawyer has heard of the Weiss case and is aware that it challenges the primacy of EU law, but maybe not everyone is familiar with the details of Weiss or Gauweiler. Can you talk us through both cases, maybe starting with the context?
Both cases are about the programs that the European Central Bank adopted in order to support the euro.
Because we are talking about a time well into the sovereign debt crisis in which there was an economic slump, high unemployment, and interest rates hovering around 0%. So the ECB was running out of options.
Yes, when you go to zero, you cannot lower it any longer. And that means that you have no monetary policy anymore. At least you cannot do it through the normal instrument, which is interest rates.
Right.
What did they do? They looked at the statute and they found other instruments they have. One is buying titles in the secondary market. And that's a way of injecting money into the economy and to keep it afloat. And also ensuring that the monetary policy has an effect on the ground. This is a tool that is there that central banks use, maybe not in the amounts that they were using it in that period. But all the central banks were doing that. The Federal Reserve was doing that. The Bank of Japan was doing that. The UK Central Bank was doing that. And the ECB started to do that quite late.
This is where quantitative easing comes in, right? And Draghi's announcement in 2012 that the ECB would do within its mandate whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. That was the first program, the ONT program.
The outright monetary transactions program, and then a couple of years later, the PSPP, the public sector purges program.
Yeah, but this kind of monetary policy, it was contested from some circles in Germany, arguing that basically that it was not real monetary policy, that this actually was economic policy. Economic policy that, in their view, remain with the member states and the union having only a power of coordination. It was also considered that this was also in breach of the no bailout clause, that this was a way of rescuing member states and various other arguments, but these were the main ones.
And there was already disagreement about these measures within the European Central Bank.
It's important to understand that the European Central Bank is a supranational institution, and that decisions are taken by majority. And it's important to know that the representative from the Bundesbank sitting in the European Central Bank voted against the OMT program and voted also against the public sector purchase program. Because probably these decisions were not in the short-term solipsistic interest of the German economy. And this is interesting because these are people who are thinking about the German economy as a distinct unit. They are not thinking as the treaties want, having regard to the European situation. They don't think about Europe or the euro area as having its own economy or its own economic policy. And it was also challenged legally for these reasons.
How did that become a constitutional law question before the German Constitutional Court?
Well, that's quite weird. That's a construction that comes from the Maastricht judgment of 1993. In Germany, to attack a law of the legislature, for example, before the Constitutional Court, you need to be directly, individually, and actually concerned by it. You need to show that, otherwise you will be inadmissible. However, when you want to attack a measure that is adopted at union level, not directly, when you want to attack German institutions, but not doing something against a measure adopted at union level, you can do it in a sort of actio popularis, and you can do it anytime, and this will be admissible, because the Constitutional Court considers that the union is not democratic or not sufficiently democratic, and therefore that shifting policy decisions from the member state to the union level diminishes your rights of participation under Article 38 of the German Constitution. This is the theory behind it. And that means that anybody, any person, Mr. X, Ms. Y, can, you know, bring before the German Constitutional Court any act of union law by saying, this is ultra vires, this is beyond the competences of the union. German institutions should have avoided that this act or this decision of the ECB was adopted. And by shifting this policy competence that should be decided by German institutions with the normal German democracy, you are actually emptying of content my right of participation under Article 38 of the German Basic Law.
Who were the applicants in these cases?
Individuals. Some of them were politicians, some of them were from the, say, extreme right, most of them. Or extreme left, not the mainstream parties.
Okay. So this is how both cases ended up before the German Constitutional Court. First Gauweiler, which was about the OMT program, and later Weiss, which is about the PSPP. And in each case, the German Constitutional Court made a reference for a preliminary ruling to the Court of Justice. And the Court of Justice, both times, held that the programs were lawful and within the powers of the ECB. But the German Constitutional Court's assessment of these programs was... let's say, counterintuitive.
Yes. The first program was much more massive. The OMT that Draghi announced, it had no limits. It was selective. It was buying titles in the secondary market of some member states only. I mean, from many points of view, it could have been much more problematic than the PSPP and the second program, which was capped and it was not selective. It was buying titles from all the member states. In Gauweiler, there was a preliminary reference to the Court of Justice, which gave its judgment, and then it came back to Karlsruhe, and in the end, the Constitutional Court in Germany declared it constitutional, with some minor disagreements or nuances. So everybody thought, okay, this is overall a positive development. When it came to the PSPP, to the second program, which, as I said, from the tenets of the jurisprudence of the German Constitutional Court should have looked much less problematic. There was a preliminary reference to Luxembourg that was much less aggressive in tone than the one in Gauweiler. And the Court of Justice, I think, thought, well, this is the usual thing. It felt, I think, relaxed. And it gave its judgment. And then, surprise, surprise, a year later, the German Constitutional Court declares the PSPP decision of the European Central Bank and the vice judgment of the Court of Justice ultra vires, unconstitutional, saying that the judgment of the court is clearly incomprehensible and, I mean, completely wrong, basically, manifestly wrong in law, as a matter of EU law. So that was quite a shock for EU lawyers.
The rhetoric of the judgment is remarkable. Eh? I mean, the rhetoric alone. It calls the Court of Justice's ruling not comprehensible, objectively arbitrary, and simply not tenable from a methodological perspective.
Yes, yes, but this is quite funny. Maybe you can think it's a bit sad, but the juge rapporteur of the judgment in the German Constitutional Court said we had to use those terms because those are the terms that are the yardstick to find an ultra vires judgment. Because you have to know that in Honeywell, a previous judgment of the German Constitutional Court, they had held that to be ultra vires, first you need to send a reference to the Court of Justice. And it's only if the Court of Justice gets the division of competences manifestly wrong, but really interpreting the treaty in a clearly incomprehensible manner, leading to a structural transgression of the order of competences, to a shift, a sort of tectonic shift in the order of competences, it's only there that we would intervene. And then the rapporteur said, this is the yardstick, so we need to say these nasty things, which it's a curious way of reasoning in legal terms. Yeah,
So what exactly were the legal grounds for saying in Weiss that there had been a tectonic shift of competences? You mentioned already that from the start, there was this discussion about whether what the ECB did was monetary policy or economic policy, the idea being that monetary policy is something the ECB can do, but economic policy is something that has to be coordinated between member states. And that becomes the central question in the Weiss case. But in the end, the German Constitutional Court doesn't say that the PSPP was economic policy. It says something different.
It's very strange because the Court of Justice said, and I think this is perfectly logical, it says, in order to determine whether a measure of the European Central Bank remains within the bounds of monetary policy, you have to look at its objectives, whether it pursues the objectives of monetary policy. And then you have to look at the tools, whether the ECB is using one of the tools which the statute of the ECB gives to it. And so in Weiss, also in Auweiler, the court said, well, this is the objective, ensuring the stability of the currency, the transmission of monetary policy, the unicity of the currency, so that monetary policy doesn't become ineffectual for some areas of the euro area. The tool, buying titles in the secondary market, it is in the statute. It's there. It's a tool of monetary policy. So the argument is fairly simple. And the court said the impact, the effects, are irrelevant because economic policy and monetary policy, they can have the same kind of impact on the real economy. That's why they are doing these policies, to have an impact. Even when you're using the interest rates, now the ECB is raising the interest rates, it has impacts which are indistinguishable from the impact of a taxation measure or an expenditure measure, which are measures of economic policy. And the German court, oddly, in the Weiss judgment said, the Court of Justice of the European Union got it wrong. You need to analyze the impact to see whether the impacts of these policy measures of the ECB start to resemble the impacts of economic policy measures. So this is, you cannot distinguish legally or economically on the basis of the impact. But this is the yardstick and the test that the German Constitutional Court is using in Weiss. And then it says, how do you distinguish? You will do it on the basis of the principle of proportionality. If a measure of monetary policy suddenly has a disproportionate impact vis-a-vis its objective, hocus pocus, it becomes a measure of economic policy, and therefore it's ultra-virus. And that's the second, I think, shift that is odd in terms of legal technique, because proportionality is a condition for the legality of a measure. We agree on that. But proportionality is not about the division of powers. It's about the intensity of the action when you have the power to do something. Now, monetary policy is an exclusive competence. So even considering that you could have a disproportionate measure of monetary policy, it doesn't make it economic policy. It simply means that it is disproportionate monetary policy. It would be intra vires, but it would be illegal in terms of substance. And in its own case law, the German Constitutional Court, on the division of powers between the lender and the Bund, it has said that the principle of proportionality is not relevant as a matter of German law. So,
yeah, it's a really unorthodox move to fuse the question of competence and proportionality in this way.
It doesn't even say that the measure is disproportionate. It says that the grounds given for it in the judgment of the court and in the decision of the ECB do not conform to its conception of the policy and of its proportionality, and that it cannot examine it. And therefore, it considers it ultra vires because of lack of grounds. And that's I think, a very strange in legal terms, because how can the lack of grounds of a measure render it ultra vires? It's a formal requirement. It cannot have an impact on the analysis of competence.
But then how should we understand this judgment? I'm asking also because practically the case had very little consequences for...
No consequences.
There's another ECB program, the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program, for which a challenge is still pending in the German Constitutional Court. And we'll have to see how that plays out. But the PSPP, the one this judgment was about, stayed in place. So how should we make sense of the judgment?
It's difficult to make sense of these in technical legal terms. It's about something else. It's a statement. also, if you consider that in the end, the ECB adapted a little bit its communication on these kinds of measures while raising the purchase of title even more, and nothing happened really. Nothing happened, nothing changed. Then my deep impression was that the objective of this very dubious intervention from the German Constitutional Court was not the ECB. In reality, it was the Court of Justice, because what remains of this judgment is the holding that a judgment of the Court of Justice is ultra vires, because it's manifestly incomprehensible and utterly wrong. As a matter of EU law, because the German court is saying you got it wrong as a matter of EU law, so you're not an authoritative interpreter of your own law. And this, I think, is a legal utterance of huge and very, very dangerous proportions. Yeah.
If the target was not the ECB, but the ECJ, as you say, then what is the real impact of this judgment, the real danger?
It breaks the myth. It's breaking the taboo, and many other courts may be tempted to follow. And some have followed, notably the Polish Constitutional Court. And I don't want to say that what the German court did in Weiss is the same as the Constitutional Court of Poland did in these cases about independence of judges and Article 6 of the European Convention of Human Rights. Is not the same. The Constitutional Tribunal of Poland is much more, how can I say, brutal in its intervention, declaring that Article 19 of the treaty is unconstitutional. It's not the same. It's what I'm trying to say is that when you break the taboo, others may feel empowered and legitimized to do that in ever most egregious ways. This is, I think, it was a lack of sensitivity on the part of the judges of the Second Senate of the Constitutional Court in Germany. The then president, Forskule, declared to a newspaper, they asked him, well, weren't you thinking about Poland and Hungary and what they would do? And they said, the Poles do what the Poles do and we do what we do. So I think that shows a sort of self-involvement and a sort of very limited normative and institutional horizon, and not seeing that an intervention of the German Constitutional Court on a matter of European concern, such as the public sector purchase program, is not just about Germany. And declaring a judgment of the Court of Justice ultra vires and manifestly or incomprehensible, this will have an impact in the Union as a whole. So I find it a bit strange, this intervention. At the same time, historically, at this point of time, is very understandable. I mean, you could expect it.
Why is that?
Because we seem to have come round circle in this whole history of post-war reconstruction, where, in a way, the integration would have been the... This is the theory of Alan Millward in the European rescue of the nation state. Integration would have been the sort of the, you know, when you do works in your home, you have to repair something, they put the scaffolding. At the end, when the house is rebuilt, they take away the scaffolding. And in this view, which is out there, the integration would be a scaffolding that had been there to reconstruct the member states, the nation state, for a long time. And now that they are reconstructed, the scaffolding would be useless and you just take it away. So this kind of pronouncements, now passing from words to facts, I think what they are saying is, look, the reality of power is in the state and the union is a fragile, contingent construction. And I think that's wrong, historically blind, because the state is also weak and fragile and also has these destructive tendencies sometimes. And it's wrong to forget about them. Yeah, I think it's wrong to forget about them.
What's the way forward from this? Now that the German Constitutional Court has gone from words of warning, to deeds, to actually declaring a judgment of the Court of Justice ultra vires.
I have the hope that, seeing what is happening, that some people in the German Constitutional Court may realize that they have to change that case law. that they have to enlarge their normative horizon, that they have to be, you know, a positive actor in the process of legal integration and not just a negative influence, a sort of veto here, a veto there, a limit here, a limit there. Because if every constitutional court or Supreme Court in Europe starts doing that, in the end, EU law is going to be unrecognizable. It would become defracted into 27 versions of it. And then the whole point of the union and its law would be gone. But there has to be, in the legal profession, in the constitutional professors, there has to be some shift, some broadening of their views. They have to start to realize that the normative orders in the union are so interlinked that it's not possible anymore to think about them with this state-centered perspective that the German court is using. If they keep on thinking about union law and the union from that perspective, then it becomes an impossibility.
In your book, you write that we could choose to rediscover the law of integration and learn to see it again as a precious asset that we have received in trust. How do we go about that? How do we reclaim the law of integration?
Well, I think that has something to do with the way people in the legal profession work and think about their work and about their own role as lawyers, as jurists. Very often, I do it as well. We tend to work technically, in the box, in the technical legal work, the argument, the rule, the interpretation. And we think about the law in logical terms, but we don't think about it chronologically in the way the law is built and develops. And we don't think about it culturally in the way that law is an institutional feature of our societies and governs human relationships, structures. We don't see that. We tend to work within the system. And sometimes I think to be a good lawyer, you have to have this double vision. You have to be the technician, and sometimes you have to, you know, take a couple of steps back to look at what you're doing, what it means. For union law, this means, I think, to try to understand the meaning of this creation. What does it mean? Why is it there? What is its function? Why do we have a European Union instead of nothing? Why did it come into existence? What does it mean today? Why is it changing? In what direction is changing? What am I doing in all that, in my limited role? And something very important, which is when we work in this field, I think you have to work as a European. That's something that Pierre Pescatore told me, and I agree with him, that, I mean, your national identity, when you work on these issues, you have to leave it at the door. And you have to think in European terms. Otherwise, you will never be able to become a real European lawyer. You will be doing something else, but not European law. And today, in this period where I think we're a bit lost, the EU lawyers are a bit lost, it's refreshing to look at the beginnings. And this can give meaning to the whole enterprise again, a refresh meaning, not the same, but with similar ideas. Some people think and say, oh, the old forms of integration are dead and the new ones are not yet there. And I think that's wrong thinking. That's this wishful thinking that you can invent something from the scratch. And this is not possible. You always have to work with the things that you have received.
I think that's a great place to end. So the final question, name three books that have influenced you that you would recommend to the audience.
Yes. I have chosen three books. One is The Enigma of Arrival by V.S. Naipaul. And this is a great novel about himself. So it's not really fiction, but it's a novel. And it's about his retreat in a cottage in the English countryside where he goes to write. And he starts to remember the moment he left Trinidad, his island, via New York to go with a scholarship to study at Oxford or Cambridge. And his feelings then of displacement, feelings of being completely out of place in Great Britain, being a foreigner, being detached, observing things, observing nature, observing the Brits in the countryside. it's a very rich position to be in retreat, observing and analyzing processes, analyzing things, how they go, how things change constantly, and with some detachment. At the same time, with a lot of empathy and sensitivity for things. It's a great book, The Enigma of Arrival by V.S. Naipaul. The second book is this book by Sebald, The Rings of Saturn. I have it in Spanish here, Los Anillos de Saturno. It's Sebald himself, again, talking about himself, and he goes traveling by foot in the English countryside. And during his travels, he sees things, reads things, talks to people, and starts reflecting about the transformation of the UK and Europe through the 20th, even 19th century industrialism, colonialism, the war, and starts seeing everywhere the traces of past periods and the ruins they have left, and the wounds as well. I think you learn more about European law and integration if you read this than if you read, I don't know, Craig and the Burka. This is a joke, but you learn more about the tragic, sad, dense, meaningful history of Europe and what we have inherited if you read this than if you read many technical books about EU law. This is a great masterpiece. And the third book I've chosen is by Olga Tokarczuk, the Polish but really European and I think cosmopolitan writer called Flights. And this is also a very, very curious book which mixes a point of view, genre. Sometimes it's a short story, sometimes it looks like an essay. It changes times, places, characters. There is no link between the parts. You don't see many books because the literary forms are predetermined by old usage. But today, I don't think they correspond all the time with our experience. And this book, the way it's written, the stories it tells, it corresponds much more with our consciousness and the way we are. It gives you, I think, a very, very vivid image of what it's like to live in the present.
You have also written novels yourself.
Yes, some. I like to write. I've always written.
Have these three authors, Naipaul, Sebald, Tokarczuk, have they influenced you as a writer?
Naipaul, the way he writes, the things he writes, I feel a huge affinity with it. And it's the way I try to write even before I read Naipaul. Tokarczuk, Sebald, I admire a lot. It's very enriching for me, but it's not the way I would write. But I think it's wonderful, yeah.
Julio, thank you very much. Your book is What's Left of the Law of Integration. It's profound, it's beautifully written, and it covers much more than we were able to talk about in this conversation. I can recommend it to everyone.
Thanks to you, Felix.
You've been listening to Europa Felix. Check out the show notes for a list of the case law and the literature mentioned in this episode. You can find transcripts and more episodes on the website. If you have comments or guest suggestions, my email is felix@europafelix.eu.